So, Mr. Power, we are going to start with you.
Good morning. May it please the Court. We're here today to question how the District Court could possibly have attributed any plausibility whatsoever to a claim that a patent is infringed by the very product that was sold prior to its critical date. This is not a claim that can be measured along a continuum.
I thought it was uncertain whether they were the same.
It's not uncertain at all. That was a fiction that was created by the plaintiff that carried the case for a while.
So on the on-sale bar, when you moved for summary judgment, did you put in evidence of your own testing the March through May 2007 or to July 2007 P7880s to see if they were in fact the same as the post-July 2011, that is post-patent units?
But that's not necessary at all.
Just asked a factual question. My understanding is you did not, right?
We did not, that's correct.
And the District Court, in ruling on your favor, relied entirely on an interpretation of an assertion in the first amended complaint that the court interpreted to mean all of the P7880s were infringing regardless of date, and therefore that must have included the pre-critical date ones.
Exactly. There was one product here.
So, and you don't think that the question of how to interpret that assertion was, had any doubt about it, or rather that the district court couldn't properly conclude, as the district court did, that basis was meritless but not unreasonable for Seoul to contest?
Not at all, because the complaint alleged infringement of the P7880. And there happened to have been two shipments from the manufacturer of the product, and the plaintiff latched onto that concept that, oh, there are two shipments, so now there are two products. But there weren't. The complaint alleged infringement of the entirety of the P7880. And according to the local rules in the Southern District, they were given an opportunity to amend after we filed our motion for Rule 12C. They had the evidence that we gave them before we answered the complaint. We answered the complaint, and we moved for judgment on the pleadings, suggesting that let's hold everything off and let the plaintiff learn through discovery to confirm that these sales were actually made beforehand. And they were given the opportunity to amend their complaint to limit their allegations of infringement in whatever way they'd like, between the first shipment, second shipment, before issuance of patents, after issuance of the patent, and they chose not to do this. So they would rely on their amended complaint as filed. And you'll find that in docket number 21 and 26 in the record.
Okay, is that in the joint appendix? Docket numbers take a lot of time to translate.
The summary of them is at appendix 19, but it didn't make it into the appendix. Okay. Now the district court.
I have a few procedural questions. I don't even know if they're procedural, but just I'm trying to understand what happened. I think that there were seven patents at issue in the case, right?
Originally.
And then one patent was found, eventually summary judgment, it was invalid based on the on sale bar.
Two patents.
And then five other patents, you tried to show that they were invalid and you were not successful, is that right? On summary judgment.
I don't recall.
There was some denial of summary judgment on the other five patents.
Yes, but it was based upon evidence of infringement. We had a totally unprepared 30B6 witness from the plaintiff who just couldn't even identify samples or anything. And we, at the point of summary judgment, we said, look, they haven't made their case.
It was denied.
And it was denied because the judge said there are still factual issues.
I'm just wondering, and then those cases, there was some sort of settlement, I guess, with those five patents?
Yeah, after summary judgment disposed of 85% of the value of the case, which is the P7880 product. The 207 patent, which was asserted against it as prior art, was on summary judgment. The other was a process patent. And at the very beginning of the case, we demonstrated that all of the product that was being charged with infringement of the process patent was received by the defendant, by D3.
I just want to make sure my questions really are just going to something that's not even an issue before us. But why was there no question about who is the prevailing party? I mean, it's kind of weird in a situation like this. I mean, attorney fees are only going to be awarded to the prevailing party. And here, well, five patents on which summary judgment was not granted in your favor and which were settled aren't even being considered. And in looking at whether this is an exceptional case, those are just kind of off the table because there's a settlement. That seems a little odd to me.
A party can be a prevailing case on a single claim or a set of claims in a case. In this case, the claims that were exceptional, we prevailed on, covered 85% of the value of the case. The other five patents were asserted against a separate product.
Are you making that determination that a party can be a prevailing party in a case just because they prevailed on a particular issue? Is that based on case law?
Yes, it is. And that was addressed thoroughly in the court below. And the court correctly decided that we were the prevailing party for the purpose of Section 285.
Where is that?
We'll find that in the... District Court decided that agreed with us that we were the prevailing party. So it wasn't an issue on appeal either way. So we don't have that issue raised. While we're looking for that, I think I've answered your questions. There was a separate product. Once summary judgment was decided on the 207 patent, which is invalidated under Evans and Van Moore, and the 626, because they didn't provide any prior notice of infringement as required by 287. Those five claims, which were valued at $1,100 total by their expert, were settled very easily. But they were dragged through the entire case with Markman proceedings, etc., because of these completely futile claims that they were pursuing on the P7880. This court held in Energy Heating that the district courts must articulate its grounds for granting or denying attorney's fees as a basis for its review as an abuse of discretion. Now, when we look at each ground articulated by the district court in support of its failure to find this an exceptional case.
Okay, I'm sorry. Can I just go back for one second to the prevailing party question? So the magistrate says at A997 that P3 was a prevailing party, even though only on some claims. Was that piece of the magistrate's decision appealed to the district court?
I don't think it was, no. Okay. I think there was no doubt between the parties that there was a prevailing party standing here.
Okay, sorry for the diversion.
We find that each of the grounds that the district court articulated was either contrary to law, clearly contrary to fact, or wholly incompatible with its own factual findings, or that it was an exercise, a clear error of judgment in weighing circumstances that were not supported by the record or that did not properly bear on exceptionality. Let's begin with the district's attribution of plausibility to this 207 patent claim, which accused infringement of the prior art product. We've already covered that they've declined to amend their complaint and that they intended to rely upon it as filed, deliberately maintaining its indiscriminate allegations. This case stands out not only among run-of-the-mill patent cases, but among all exceptional cases, because there is zero chance that Solviases could prevail in the claim. Either it invalidated its patent by proving infringement, or it failed in its infringement proofs, losing on its claim. I think it's useful to note that this claim also ran afoul of the Second Circuit standard for Rule 11 compliance, and that it was patently clear that the claim had absolutely no chance of success. You lose one way, you lose the other way. Yet the district court, finding no ulterior motive, credited Solviases with a genuine, albeit misguided, attempt to prevail on his futile claims. That was hardly a valid reason to excuse the continued prosecution of a knowingly futile claim. Every party wishes to prevail in this litigation. The real test, however, is whether that party knows when to quit.
So we're supposed to review the decision below for an abuse of discretion, and that decision should be based on the totality of circumstances. And so I'm having a hard time seeing how your argument would compel me, other than creating a bright line rule, would compel me to say there was an abuse of discretion here.
The Rothschild case reversed a denial of attorney's fees on the ground that the district court misjudged the strength of the case. Now that case, and I think almost every other case that I've read that's come under 285, has been something that can be measured on a sliding scale. Was it really a strong argument? Was it a weak argument? Did you have a reasonable basis to believe in that? Did you make any arguments to overrule, for example, the Vanguard and Evans case? All of the arguments
But isn't it the district court that's supposed to make all that weighing and sliding of all the different factors and
the
not
district
us?
Court, I'll go back. I'd like to go back to the energy heating case. And there, this court made it very clear that the district court must articulate its grounds. Otherwise, there's no way for the appellate court to determine whether it abused its discretion.
But here, there's a multi-page opinion explaining the grounds.
That's right. Pursuant to Octane Fitness, the district court did, as it was required, consider the totality of the circumstances. In other words, it could not neglect to consider something that was raised, and then taking that circumstance and deciding whether or not it mitigated the exceptional case that was created by the futile claim that was being asserted, or contributed to it somehow. Here, what we have is that everything that was raised as a circumstance by the district court was either contrary to fact, and I think here when you go back, there was each one, and I think we've set this out in our briefs. Each ground that they relied upon was either had no bearing on the exceptionality. For example, that they denied a procedural motion. It had nothing to do with the merits, and the court recognized that it had nothing to do with the merits when it decided the motion, as well as retrospectively on reconsideration. And there are other grounds that the basis of the plaintiffs, each of the arguments that they made, that the district court credited with some plausibility, talked about infringement de jure. Well, the item that was sold prior to the critical date was before the patent issued. There's a possibility that everything from shipment one could have been sold before they issued patent, so that didn't infringe. But none of these arguments addressed the real operative fact in Van Warren Evans. That is the factual allegation of infringement. Infringement is a question of fact. And that fact that every element is present in the claims for purposes of infringement also defeats the validity of the patent.
You're into your rebuttal, so you want to save it and
yes, I will.
From the other side. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. This is Michael Eisenberg of Steptoe and Johnson on behalf of the Appellees. Solviasis.
Okay. Can you see and hear all of us? Well, hear me?
Yes, I can, okay. Your Honor. Thank you very much.
Okay. Please proceed.
So, there was a lot said in counsel's presentation. One thing that was mentioned that I think was just an error was there was only one patent, not two patents, invalidated on the on-sale bar. It's the key issue, the 207 patent, that comes up repeatedly in the briefing from both sides. And as Judge Toronto mentioned, like there's a key issue here in Solviasis' view. We lost on the issue of validity. That I'm not raising that. I'm not trying to argue that. The issue that was presented to the district court and again on appeal was what is the quantum of evidence? What do you have to do as a defendant to show that what was actually sold before the critical date was in fact the same as what is accused of infringement? And as was questioned earlier, there was no testing. And what you then have is reliance on a logical inference, an inference that because the product was named the P77880 and was not changed, that the LEDs, structures that, and
Mr. Eisenberg, Mr. Power pointed to the fact that you could have amended the allegation in your complaint to eliminate what was found to be its inclusive reference to all the P7880s, including the pre-207 ones, but you didn't. What do you say about that?
Your Honor, we never said all P7880s. That's not what's actually in the complaint. And that
didn't the district court ultimately determine that you did say that? Because that was, in fact, the sole basis for the on-sale bar determination against you.
That was the district court judge's interpretation. But again, what we had in the complaint was images from reverse engineering showing specific features. We did not say all products. We said all products consistent with this infringement theory. And had we just had in the complaint the name P7880 and did no more, that may have been sufficient. I don't think that's the question before us. But instead, in the complaint, we included specific reverse engineering images showing the features that existed in the product that infringed. And as was explained to the district court below, and in fact on appeal, what Solinus's view of this is that when you have a complaint and you identify features, you are saying products consistent with that allegation, those detailed allegations are the ones that infringe, and that goes to the quantum of damages at the end of the case. And it may be, and defendants often do, and I have throughout my career done this many times, said, yes, you identified a product, but these other products that are encompassed within your claims are different, are materially different, and therefore fall outside of the scope of the allegations. And at the end of the day, at the end of the trial, what the plaintiff and defendant do, and this is under a reasonable identification, they identify which products, what is the quantum of products that were sold that are consistent with the infringement theory. And this happens all the time, that products change over time. And it cannot or should not be assumed that products always remain the same. And as we pointed out in our briefing up and down, that the LED industry is constantly changing. And that over time, the output, the structures have changed remarkably. And in fact, the output has changed by orders of magnitude over the last 20 years. And the implicit assumption that what was done in one set of products had to be identical to the other, we thought was not an assumption that was proper. Now, the district court disagreed. And in the end, that's how we end up where we are today. The district court said, you, Mr. Eisenberg, you had to be more careful in your allegations. And in fact, she pointed not just to the complaint, but also to the infringement contentions. And she said, in your infringement contentions, you should have been more careful in carving out what was different. And at least as I thought of it until the date that the decision came down, I did not see it that way. That was not how I understood the law. I understood the law to say a plaintiff comes forward with infringement allegations and are based on specific details and concepts and features that are in the product, and that is one burden of proof. And if a defendant wants to come forward and prove invalidity, they have to do more than what plaintiff has to do to show infringement. They have to provide clear and convincing evidence. And throughout, it was Solinus's position that it was not its obligation to come through and disprove the invalidity theory. And one of the things that Judge Nathan took me to task for, it was me, I'm here and I answer for my own conduct, was not taking discovery specifically to disprove the invalidity theory. And I did not. I did not think that that was the proper burden, that a plaintiff does not have to disprove an invalidity theory until it is established. And that is not what occurred in Solvius's view. I lost that issue. And I will rue that decision possibly for a long time. But starting with first principles again, the only party here to this case...
Mr. Eisenberg, do you happen to have in front of you Judge Nathan's summary judgment opinion? This is, I guess, at page 652 of the appendix, if I've got it right. Can you point me to where in that opinion the district court relied not only on the complaint allegation, but on the infringement contentions, which I think you said? I'm not being skeptical, I just can't find it.
Well, I mean, it goes to not just the complaints, but also interrogatory responses. This is on page 670. To qualify its infringement statement in its interrogatory responses, and I apologize if I mischaracterized. I intended to refer to both the infringement contentions and I think, in this instance, partially what she's referring to as interrogatory responses.
Okay. Sorry for taking so much time.
Oh, no problem at all, and I'm glad I can find it for you. What I was saying before that question, Your Honor, is I did not, as a plaintiff, had access to the products as they were sold prior, specifically as they were sold prior to the critical date.
Well, except through discovery, which, as I recall, you accurately characterized what the district court said. The district court said that P3 had better access to those products than you did, but you had access as well. Not directly, but through the legal process.
Exactly, and that brings up the question whether a plaintiff is ever going to specifically go forward with discovery to just prove a claim that it believes has not been established in the first instance. And again, I'm not here to criticize or correct the district court's decision, which is written in stone at this point, but instead to point out the reasonableness of my conduct, and that's in large part what we're here to talk about. This is about me and my representation of a client. And, you know, one of the things that was mentioned was Rule 11, and there's a number of issues under the Rule 11 statement. One is simply that the only basis on which Rule 11 was raised, contrary to what my friend Mr. Powers mentioned, was the motion for reconsideration. It was not the case as a whole, and it had nothing to do with the infringement contentions or anything else, but instead the question of whether seeking reconsideration of a decision that I believe to have been in error was in fact itself a violation of Rule 11. And I don't think it can or should be. I am here as I must be, as a zealous advocate for my client. I thought there was an error. I thought the decision was wrong. The district court, in fact, said that I misunderstood the decision as part of the request for reconsideration, that I misunderstood her reference to damages as being a basis of the decision, which she withdrew. And as Your Honor mentioned, that means only the complaint and other contentions in this matter as the basis for this theory that we specifically encompass the prior art. And all of the cases from the Federal Circuit that I have been able to find have included evidence of correspondence, that the specific structures and features identified and preached of infringing were found to be present in the prior art. And that was something that was missing from the record here. Judge Nathan said, we could have disproved and done discovery to establish or disprove that theory, and we did not. And on that basis, in part, we lost. Was that unreasonable? Was that exceptional? I don't think it was by any ordinary definition of exceptionality. Yes, it may be rare that a patentee invalidates its own patents, and it is not a highlight of my career to have been found to have done that. But that is not the matter of exceptionality. Exceptionality says, did something happen that was beyond the pale, something extraordinary in its continuance or filing? And in this instance, what happened was we, as the plaintiffs, determined that it should be defendants that establish invalidity by doing the analysis.
And Mr. Eisenberg, just to be clear, I mean, we're not here today to decide whether that's exceptional or not. We're here to decide whether the district court abused its discretion and how it weighed the facts and the totality of circumstances and made that determination, right?
Yes, and I very much appreciate the redirection, Your Honor, because that is the core issue. There are two judges below, a magistrate judge and a district court judge, that spent years with Mr. Powers and I and our clients. And based on a detailed review of the record by both judges reviewing their personal experience with the parties, their litigation conduct, and otherwise, decided this case was not exceptional. And the standard is an abuse of discretion. And substantially all of the cases cited by P3 in this matter are about a judge at the district court level applying the wrong law or finding, there was one example of finding an argument that the plaintiff did not make as justification for the decision. And the Federal Circuit said, well, the district court judge can't justify a plaintiff's conduct outside of what the plaintiff actually did, which makes sense because what the district court judges are supposed to be doing, the magistrate judge and the district court judge, is to consider what actually happened. And they were front row participants in much of this. And they saw what happened and viewed it and viewed the conduct of both sides, both parties, and how they went about their case. And there is an issue that was raised by Judge Toronto as well about a prevailing party. That was an issue that was raised before the district court. That was in the appendix at pages 912 through 913. We did say that that P3 had not established that it was the prevailing party after five of the patents were settled. The district court did not reach that issue, deciding instead solely on the basis that the case was not acceptable.
Can I just get some clarification of that? That was what the special master or the magistrate judge found? Or you raised
this was just an argument that was raised but was not reached by either the magistrate judge or the district court judge.
Mr. Eisenberg, at page A997, which is the magistrate's report and recommendation on fees, if I understand it right, which is, I forget what docket number it is, she says that the other side was a prevailing party, which you can be, citing some authority, even if you win on fewer than all of the claims. And I asked the question whether when you filed objections to the report and recommendation, which I think is docket 220, which is not in the joint appendix, whether you disputed that particular determination by the magistrate. Because Judge Nathan's opinion in rejecting your objections to the report and recommendation doesn't say anything about prevailing party, as far as I can tell.
Yes.
Did you object to that? That piece of the report and recommendation?
I do not recall in detail. We did, and because the magistrate judge was involved in the settlement proceedings, we did have an agreement that the settlement would not prejudice P3's ability to raise attorney's fees on the basis of the 207 patent and the invalidity there. So we did, as part of that discussion, and it is memorialized as part of the settlement agreement, it was not prejudiced to. We did raise the issue that we would have been properly considered prevailing party on 5 of the 7 patents, because we did obtain a settlement and payment. But at the end, that was not the core of the issue that was raised with Judge Nathan in seeking to just affirm the magistrate.
Mr. Eisenberg, you said, Mr. Eisenberg, you said it was not the core, but was it raised at all?
I cannot say for certain. I'm pretty sure it was, but I would need to pull that.
And it wasn't raised before this court, right?
It was not raised before. It was not raised before this court.
Okay.
Again, the core issue was the district court. Judge Brooks, you had a question?
Well, no, it's just you've exceeded your time, so I was going to ask you to wrap up.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I appreciate your patience, and I will stop now.
Thank you. All right, Mr. Power, you have a little time left on rebuttal.
Your Honors, the district court, watching this case over those years, basically blamed P3 for seeking attorney's fees. It's not entitled to seek attorney's fees. It hampered settlement negotiations by asking for attorney's fees. It was Solviasis who backed out of the magistrate's offer to hold a settlement conference because we don't want to discuss attorney's fees. On the other hand, the magistrate said that the plaintiff had the right to demand multiples of what it might accept because that's just the way parties negotiate. This was a double standard that stuck through the case, and this is why you see the district court pulling out things that really have no factual basis or any relationship to exceptionality. For example, the court said that we resisted confidentiality at the settlement conference. Nobody does that. Settlement conferences for both parties must be confidential. When you look at Appendix 262, it makes it very clear. What was hanging over all of these discussions was what Solviasis identified a misnomer as a Rule 408 agreement. And they said, this is only to make sure for 408, Federal Rule of Evidence 408 applies. Well, what it did was try to limit the use of that when a party makes a disproportionate or otherwise improper demand, a plaintiff, that can be held against them as an exceptional case. And that's what we were arguing there. We did not. It's contrary to the record. Now, addressing what my colleague said, the law is very clear. Van Moore and Evans say that a plaintiff's allegation of infringement by a product that was sold prior to the critical date satisfies the burden of proof. It itself satisfies that burden of proof of invalidity by clear and convincing evidence. It's not that the product was named by P3 as a P780. The issue was that it was named by Solviasis in his complaint. It relied upon its testing to prove infringement of all product, not just a chosen few. It was unwilling, the bottom line, to give up that claim for infringement of all P7880s. It wanted to keep it in the case, yet preserve its patent. It did not remove any product out of infringement, and it relied upon a fiction, a pure fiction, that there was anything separate to compare. They allege infringement of the P7880, and that's what was sold prior to the critical date. It's not like the other cases that he cites, where there was a different product and they had to show that there was a similarity. It was exactly the same product they alleged to infringe. And there are cases, WPEM and Big Baboon, both are unpublished decisions, but it's very clear when you look at them and you look at the district court decision that they affirmed that it was just like this case. And in fact, this case is better than Evans and Van Moore because there wasn't a distinction. We didn't have to prove anything, any similarity between two things that weren't different. A is the same as A. That's what they wanted us to prove. And their claims are absolutely futile. Prove infringement, you lose. Don't prove infringement, you lose. And the fact that they pursued this case through Markman, discovery, and dragged P3 through it, not refusing to enter into settlement discussions because we told them at the beginning of the case that we were going to seek attorney's fees unless they withdrew the case and we were going to let them walk away. We said, go away, because when we answer the complaint, our fees are going to be much more than you're ever going to recover in this case.
You've exceeded your time.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Both sides, and the case is submitted.